The men in Washington were last to be reached by the panic. They watched not the news from Minnesota, but the precarious balance of their friendships and commitments. They weighed not the fate of the harvest, but the unknowable result of unpredictable emotions in unthinking men of unlimited power. They waited. They evaded all pleas. They declared, "Oh, ridiculous, there's nothing to worry about. Those Taggart people have always moved that wheat on schedule. They'll find some way to move it." Then when the state chief executive of Minnesota sent a request to Washington for the assistance of the army against the riots he was unable to control, three directives burst forth within 2 hours, stopping all trains in the country, commandeering all cars to speed to Minnesota. An order signed by Wesley Mooch demanded the immediate release of the freight cars held in the service of Kip's Ma. But by that time it was too late. Ma's freight cars were in California, where the soybeans had been sent to a progressive concern made up of sociologists preaching the cult of Oriental austerity and of businessmen formerly in the numbers racket. In Minnesota, farmers were setting fire to their own farms. They were demolishing grain elevators in the homes of county officials. They were fighting along the track of the railroad, some to tear it up, some to defend it with their lives. And with no goal to reach save violence, they were dying in the streets of gutted towns and in the silent gullies of a roadless night. Then there was only the acrid stench of grain, rotting in half-smoldering piles. A few columns of smoke rising from the plains, standing still in the air over blackened ruins. And in an office in Pennsylvania, Hank Reardon sitting at his desk, looking at a list of men who had gone bankrupt. They were the manufacturers of farm equipment, who could not be paid and would not be able to pay him. The harvest of soybeans did not reach the markets of the country. It had been reaped prematurely. It was moldy and unfit for consumption. On the night of October 15th, a copper wire broke in New York City in an underground control tower of the Taggart Terminal, extinguishing the lights of the signals. It was only the breach of one wire, but it produced a short circuit in the interlocking traffic system, and the signals of motion or danger disappeared from the panels of the control towers and from among the strands of rail. The red and green lenses remained red and green, not with the living radiance of sight, but with the dead stare of glass eyes. On the edge of the city, a cluster of trains gathered at the entrance to the terminal tunnels and grew through the minutes of stillness like blood dammed by a clot inside a vein, unable to rush into the chambers of the heart. Dagny that night was sitting at a table in a private dining room of the Wayne Falkland. The wax of candles was dripping down on the white camellias and laurel leaves at the base of the silver candlesticks. Arithmetical calculations were penciled on the damask linen tablecloth, and a cigar butt was swimming in a finger bowl. The six men in formal dinner jackets facing her about the table were Wesley Mooch, Eugene Lawson, Dr. Floyd Ferris, Clem Weatherby, James Taggart, and Cuffy Meggs. "Why?" she had asked, when Jim had told her that she had to attend that dinner. "Well, because our board of directors is to meet next week." "And?" "You're interested in what's going to be decided about our Minnesota line, aren't you?"
"Is that going to be decided at the board meeting?"
"Well, not exactly."
"Is it going to be decided at this dinner?"
"Not exactly, but..." "Oh, why do you always have to be so definite? Nothing's ever definite. Besides, they insisted that they wanted you to come."
"Why?"
"Isn't that sufficient?"
She did not ask why those men chose to make all their crucial decisions at parties of this kind. She knew that they did. She knew that behind the clattering, lumbering pretense of their council sessions, committee meetings, and mass debates, the decisions were made in advance, in furtive informality, at luncheons, dinners, and bars. The graver the issue, the more casual the method of settling it. It was the first time that they had asked her, the outsider, the enemy, to one of those secret sessions. It was, she thought, an acknowledgment of the fact that they needed her, and perhaps the first step of their surrender. It was a chance she could not leave untaken. But as she sat in the candlelight of the dining room, she felt certain that she had no chance. She felt restlessly unable to accept that certainty, since she could not grasp its reason, yet lethargically reluctant to pursue any inquiry.
"As I think you will concede, Miss Taggart, there now seems to be no economic justification for the continued existence of a railroad line in Minnesota, which..."
"And even Miss Taggart will, I'm sure, agree that certain temporary retrenchments seem to be indicated until..."
Nobody, not even Miss Taggart, will deny that there are times when it is necessary to sacrifice the parts for the sake of the whole. As she listened to the mentions of her name, tossed into the conversation at half-hour intervals, tossed perfunctorily, with the speaker's eyes never glancing in her direction, she wondered what motive had made them want her to be present. It was not an attempt to delude her into believing that they were consulting her, but worse, an attempt to delude themselves into believing that she had agreed. They asked her questions at times and interrupted her before she had completed the first sentence of the answer. They seemed to want her approval without having to know whether she approved or not. Some crudely childish form of self-deception had made them choose to give to this occasion the decorous setting of a formal dinner. They acted as if they hoped to gain from the objects of gracious luxury the power and the honor of which those objects had once been the product and symbol. They acted, she thought, like those savages who devour the corpse of an adversary in the hope of acquiring his strength and his virtue. She regretted that she was dressed as she was. "It's formal," Jim had told her, "but don't overdo it. What I mean is, don't look too rich. Business people should avoid any appearance of arrogance these days. Not that you should look shabby, but if you could just seem to suggest, well, humility. It would please them, you know. It would make them feel big."
"Really?" she had said, turning away.
She wore a black dress that looked as if it were no more than a piece of cloth crossed over her breasts and falling to her feet in the soft folds of a Grecian tunic. It was made of satin, a satin so light and thin that it could have served as the stuff of a nightgown. The luster of the cloth, streaming and shifting with her movements, made it look as if the light of the room she entered were her personal property, sensitively obedient to the motions of her body, wrapping her in a sheet of radiance more luxurious than the texture of brocade, underscoring the pliant fragility of her figure, giving her an air of so natural an elegance that it could afford to be scornfully casual. She wore a single piece of jewelry, a diamond clip at the edge of the black neckline that kept flashing with the imperceptible motion of her breath, like a transformer converting a flicker into fire, making one conscious not of the gems, but of the living beat behind them. It flashed like a military decoration, like wealth worn as a badge of honor. She wore no other ornament, only the sweep of a black velvet cape, more arrogantly ostentatiously patrician than any spread of sables. She regretted it now, as she looked at the men before her. She felt the embarrassing guilt of pointlessness, as if she had tried to defy the figures in a waxworks. She saw a mindless resentment in their eyes, and a sneaking trace of the lifeless, sexless, smutty leer with which men look at a poster advertising burlesque. "It's a great responsibility," said Eugene Lawson, "to hold the decision of life or death over thousands of people, and to sacrifice them when necessary. But we must have the courage to do it." His soft lips seemed to twist into a smile. "The only factors to consider are land acreage and population figures," said Dr. Ferris in a statistical voice, blowing smoke rings at the ceiling. "Since it is no longer possible to maintain both the Minnesota line and the transcontinental traffic of the railroad, the choice is between Minnesota and those states west of the Rockies, which were cut off by the failure of the Taggart Tunnel, as well as the neighboring states of Montana, Idaho, Oregon, which means, practically speaking, the whole of the Northwest. When you compute the acreage and the number of heads in both areas, it's obvious that we should scuttle Minnesota rather than give up our lines of communication over a third of a continent."
"I won't give up the continent," said Wesley Mooch, staring down at his dish of ice cream, his voice hurt and stubborn.
She was thinking of the Mesabi Range, the last of the major sources of iron ore. She was thinking of the Minnesota farmers, such as were left of them, the best producers of wheat in the country. She was thinking that the end of Minnesota would end Wisconsin, then Michigan, then Illinois. She was seeing the red breath of the factories dying out over the industrial East, as against the empty miles of western sands, of scraggly pastures and abandoned ranches. "The figures indicate," said Mr. Weatherby primly, "that the continued maintenance of both areas seems to be impossible. The railway track and equipment of one has to be dismantled to provide the material for the maintenance of the other." She noticed that Clem Weatherby, their technical expert on railroads, was the man of least influence among them, and Cuffy Meggs of most. Cuffy Meggs sat sprawled in his chair with a look of patronizing tolerance for their game of wasting time on discussions. He spoke a little, but when he did, it was to snap decisively with a contemptuous grin. "Pipe down, Jimmy." Or, "Nuts, Wes, you're talking through your hat." She noted that neither Jim nor Mooch resented it. They seemed to welcome the authority of his assurance. They were accepting him as their master.
"We have to be practical," Dr. Ferris kept saying. "We have to be scientific."
"I need the economy of the country as a whole," Wesley Mooch kept repeating. "I need the production of a nation."
"Is it economics that you're talking about? Is it production?" she said, whenever her cold, measured voice was able to seize a brief stretch of their time. "If it is, then give us leeway to save the eastern states. That's all that's left of the country and of the world. If you let us save that, we'll have a chance to rebuild the rest. If not, it's the end. Let the Atlantic Southern take care of such transcontinental traffic as still exists. Let the local railroads take care of the Northwest. But let Taggart Transcontinental drop everything else, yes, everything, and devote all our resources, equipment, and rail to the traffic of the eastern states. Let us shrink back to the start of this country, but let us hold that start. We'll run no trains west of the Missouri. We'll become a local railroad, the local of the industrial east. Let us save our industries. There's nothing left to save in the West. You can run agriculture for centuries by manual labor and ox carts, but destroy the last of this country's industrial plant, and centuries of effort won't be able to rebuild it or to gather the economic strength to make a start. How do you expect our industries or railroads to survive without steel? How do you expect any steel to be produced if you cut off the supply of iron ore? Save Minnesota, whatever's left of it. The country? You have no country to save if its industries perish. You can sacrifice a leg or an arm. You can't save a body by sacrificing its heart and brain. Save our industries. Save Minnesota. Save the eastern seaboard. It was no use. She said it as many times, with as many details, statistics, figures, proofs, as she could force out of her weary mind into their evasive hearing. It was no use. They neither refuted nor agreed. They merely looked as if her arguments were beside the point. There was a sound of hidden emphasis in their answers, as if they were giving her an explanation, but in a code to which she had no key.
"There's trouble in California," said Wesley Mooch sullenly. "Their state legislature's been acting pretty huffy. There's talk of seceding from the Union."
"Oregon is overrun by gangs of deserters," said Clem Weatherby cautiously. "They murdered 2 tax collectors within the last 3 months."
"The importance of industry to a civilization has been grossly overemphasized," said Dr. Ferris dreamily. "What is now known as the People's State of India has existed for centuries without any industrial development whatever."
"People could do with fewer material gadgets and a sterner discipline of privations," said Eugene Lawson eagerly. "It would be good for them." "Oh, hell, are you going to let that dame talk you into letting the richest country on earth slip through your fingers?" said Cuffy Meggs, leaping to his feet. "It's a fine time to give up a whole continent in exchange for what? For a dinky little state that's milked dry anyway. I say ditch Minnesota, but hold on to your transcontinental dragnet. With trouble and riots everywhere, you won't be able to keep people in line unless you have transportation. Troop transportation. Unless you hold your soldiers within a few days' journey of any point on the continent. This is no time to retrench. Don't get yellow listening to all that talk. You've got the country in your pocket. Just keep it there."
"In the long run," Mooch started uncertainly.
"In the long run, we'll all be dead," snapped Cuffy Meggs.
He was pacing restlessly.
"Retrenching, hell, there's plenty of pickings left in California and Oregon and all those places. What I've been thinking is we ought to think of expanding. The way things are, there's nobody to stop us. It's there for the taking, Mexico and Canada, maybe. It ought to be a cinch."
Then she saw the answer. She saw the secret premise behind their words. With all of their noisy devotion to the age of science, their hysterically technological jargon, their cyclotrons, their sound rays, these men were moved forward not by the image of an industrial skyline, but by the vision of that form of existence which the industrialists had swept away. The vision of a fat, unhygienic Rajah of India, with vacant eyes staring in indolent stupor out of stagnant layers of flesh, with nothing to do but run precious gems through his fingers. And once in a while, stick a knife into the body of a starved, toil-dazed, germ-eaten creature, as a claim to a few grains of the creature's rice, then claim it from hundreds of millions of such creatures, and thus let the rice grains gather into gems. She had thought that industrial production was a value not to be questioned by anyone. She had thought that these men's urge to expropriate the factories of others was their acknowledgement of the factory's value. She, born of the Industrial Revolution, had not held as conceivable, had forgotten, along with the tales of astrology and alchemy, what these men knew in their secret, furtive souls, knew not by means of thought, but by means of that nameless muck which they called their instincts and emotions, that so long as men struggle to stay alive, they'll never produce so little, but that the man with the club won't be able to seize it and leave them still less, provided millions of them are willing to submit, that the harder their work and the less their gain, the more submissive the fiber of their spirit, that men who live by pulling levers at an electric switchboard are not easily ruled, but men who live by digging the soil with their naked fingers are, that the feudal baron did not need electronic factories in order to drink his brains away out of jeweled goblets, and neither did the rajahs of the People's State of India. She saw what they wanted, and to what goal their instincts, which they called unaccountable, were leading them. She saw that Eugene Lawson, the humanitarian, took pleasure at the prospect of human starvation, and Dr. Ferris, the scientist, was dreaming of the day when men would return to the hand plow. Incredulity and indifference were her only reaction. Incredulity because she could not conceive of what would bring human beings to such a state. Indifference because she could not regard those who reached it as human any longer. They went on talking, but she was unable to speak or to listen. She caught herself feeling that her only desire was now to get home and fall asleep. "Miss Taggart," said a politely rational, faintly anxious voice, and jerking her head up, she saw the courteous figure of a waiter. "The assistant manager of the Taggart terminal's on the telephone, requesting permission to speak to you at once. He says it's an emergency." It was a relief to leap to her feet and get out of that room, even if in answer to the call of some new disaster. It was a relief to hear the assistant manager's voice, even though it was saying, "The interlocker system is out, Miss Taggart. The signals are dead. There are 8 incoming trains held up and 6 outgoing. We can't move them in or out of the tunnels. We can't find the chief engineer. We can't locate the breach in the circuit. We have no copper wire for repairs. We don't know what to do. I'll be right down," she said, dropping the receiver. Hurrying to the elevator, then half running through the stately lobby of the Wayne Falkland, she felt herself returning to life at the summons of the possibility of action. Taxicabs were rare these days, and none came in answer to the doorman's whistle. She started rapidly down the street, forgetting what she wore, wondering why the touch of the wind seemed too cold and too intimately close. Her mind on the terminal ahead, she was startled by the loveliness of a sudden sight. She saw the slender figure of a woman hurrying toward her, the ray of a lamppost sweeping over lustrous hair, naked arms, the swirl of a black cape and the flame of a diamond on her breast, with the long empty corridor of a city street behind her, and skyscrapers drawn by lonely dots of light. The knowledge that she was seeing her own reflection in the side mirror of a florist's window came an instant too late. She had felt the enchantment of the full context to which that image and city belonged. Then she felt a stab of desolate loneliness, much wider a loneliness than the span of an empty street, and a stab of anger at herself, at the preposterous contrast between her appearance and the context of this night and age. She saw a taxi turn a corner. She waved to it and leaped in, slamming the door against a feeling which she hoped to leave behind her, on the empty pavement by a florist's window. But she knew, in self-mockery, in bitterness, in longing, that this feeling was the sense of expectation she had felt at her first ball, and at those rare times when she had wanted the outward beauty of existence to match its inner splendor. What a time to think of it, she told herself in mockery. Not now, she cried to herself in anger. But a desolate voice kept asking her quietly to the rattle of the taxi's wheels, "You who believed you must live for your happiness, what do you now have left of it? What are you gaining from your struggle? Yes, say it honestly, what's in it for you? Or are you becoming one of those abject altruists who has no answer to that question any longer.
"Not now," she ordered, as the glowing entrance to the Taggart terminal flared up in the rectangle of the taxi's windshield.
The men in the terminal manager's office were like extinguished signals, as if here too a circuit were broken and there were no living current to make them move. They looked at her with a kind of inanimate passivity, as if it made no difference whether she let them stay still or threw a switch to set them in motion. The terminal manager was absent. The chief engineer could not be found. He had been seen at the terminal 2 hours ago, not since. The assistant manager had exhausted his power of initiative by volunteering to call her. The others volunteered nothing. The signal engineer was a college boyish man in his 30s, who kept saying aggressively, "But this has never happened before, Miss Taggart. The interlocker has never failed. It's not supposed to fail. We know our jobs. We can take care of it as well as anybody can, but not if it breaks down when it's not supposed to." She could not tell whether the dispatcher, an elderly man with years of railroad work behind him, still retained his intelligence but chose to hide it, or whether months of suppressing it had choked it for good, granting him the safety of stagnation.
"We don't know what to do, Miss Taggart.
We don't know whom to call for what sort of permission. There are no rules to cover an emergency of this kind."
"There aren't even any rules about who's to lay down the rules for it."
She listened. She reached for the telephone without a word of explanation. She ordered the operator to get her the operating vice president of the Atlantic Southern in Chicago, to get him at his home and out of bed if necessary.
"George Dagny Taggart," she said when the voice of her competitor came on the wire. "Will you lend me the signal engineer of your Chicago terminal, Charles Murray, for 24 hours?
"Yes."
"Right. Put him aboard a plane and get him here as fast as you can. Tell him we'll pay $3,000.
"Yes, for the one day."
"Yes, as bad as that."
"Yes, I'll pay him in cash out of my own pocket if necessary. I'll pay whatever it takes to bribe his way aboard a plane, but get him on the first plane out of Chicago."
"No, George, not one. Not a single mind left on Taggart Transcontinental."
"Yes, I'll get all the papers, exemptions, exceptions, and emergency permissions."
"Thanks, George. So long."
She hung up and spoke rapidly to the men before her, not to hear the stillness of the room and of the terminal, where no sound of wheels was beating any longer, not to hear the bitter words which the stillness seemed to repeat. "Not a single mind left on Taggart Transcontinental." "Get a wrecking train and crew ready at once," she said. "Send them out on the Hudson line, with orders to tear down every foot of copper wire, any copper wire, lights, signals, telephone, everything that's company property. Have it here by morning."
"But, Miss Taggart, our service on the Hudson line is only temporarily suspended, and the Unification Board has refused us permission to dismantle the line."
"I'll be responsible."
"But how are we going to get the wrecking train out of here when there aren't any signals?"
"There will be signals in half an hour."
"How?"
"Come on," she said, rising to her feet.
They followed her as she hurried down the passenger platforms, past the huddling, shifting groups of travelers, by the motionless trains. She hurried down a narrow catwalk, through a maze of rail, past blinded signals and frozen switches, with nothing but the beat of her satin sandals to fill the great vaults of the underground tunnels of Taggart Transcontinental, with the hollow creaking of planks, under the slower steps of men trailing her like a reluctant echo. She hurried to the lighted glass cube of Tower A, that hung in the darkness like a crown without a body, the crown of a deposed ruler, above a realm of empty tracks. The tower director was too expert a man at too exacting a job to be able wholly to conceal the dangerous burden of intelligence. He understood what she wanted him to do from her first few words and answered only with an abrupt, "Yes, ma'am." But he was bent over his charts by the time the others came following her up the iron stairway. He was grimly at work on the most humiliating job of calculation he had ever had to perform in his long career. She knew how fully he understood it. From a single glance he threw at her, a glance of indignation and endurance that matched some emotion he had caught in her face. "We'll do it first and feel about it afterwards," she said, even though he had made no comment.
"Yes, ma'am," he answered woodenly.
His room, on the top of an underground tower, was like a glass veranda overlooking what had once been the swiftest, richest, and most orderly stream in the world. He had been trained to chart the course of over 90 trains an hour, and to watch them roll safely through a maze of tracks and switches in and out of the terminal, under his glass walls and his fingertips. Now, for the first time, he was looking out at the empty darkness of a dried channel. Through the open door of the relay room, she saw the tower men standing grimly idle, the men whose jobs had never permitted a moment's relaxation, standing by the long rows that looked like vertical copper pleats, like shelves of books, and as much of a monument to human intelligence. The pull of one of the small levers, which protruded like bookmarks from the shelves, threw thousands of electric circuits into motion, made thousands of contacts, and broke as many others, set dozens of switches to clear a chosen course, and dozens of signals to light it, with no error left possible, no chance, no contradiction. An enormous complexity of thought condensed into one movement of a human hand to set and ensure the course of a train, that hundreds of trains might safely rush by, that thousands of tons of metal and lives might pass in speeding streaks a breath away from one another, protected by nothing but a thought, the thought of the man who devised the levers. But they, she looked at the face of her signal engineer, they believed that that muscular contraction of a hand was the only thing required to move the traffic. And now the tower men stood idle. And on the great panels in front of the tower director, the red and green lights which had flashed announcing the progress of trains at a distance of miles were now so many glass beads, like the glass beads for which another breed of savages had once sold the island of Manhattan. "Call all of your unskilled laborers," she said to the assistant manager, "the section hands, track walkers, engine wipers, whoever's in the terminal right now, and have them come here at once."
"Here?"
"Here," she said, pointing at the tracks outside the tower. "Call all your switchmen, too. Phone your storehouse and have them bring here every lantern they can lay their hands on. Any sort of lantern. Conductor's lanterns, storm lanterns, anything."
"Lanterns, Miss Taggart? Get going."
"Yes, ma'am."
"What is it we're doing, Miss Taggart?" asked the dispatcher.
"We're going to move trains, and we're going to move them manually."
"Manually?" said the signal engineer.
"Yes, brother."
"Now why should you be shocked?" She could not resist it. "Man is only muscles, isn't he? We're going back. Back to where there were no interlocking systems, no semaphores, no electricity. Back to the time when train signals were not steel and wire, but men holding lanterns. Physical men serving as lampposts. You've advocated it long enough, you got what you wanted. Oh, you thought that your tools would determine your ideas? But it happens to be the other way around, and now you're going to see the kind of tools your ideas have determined." But even to go back took an act of intelligence, she thought, feeling the paradox of her own position, as she looked at the lethargy of the faces around her.
"How will we work the switches, Miss Taggart?"
"By hand."
"And the signals?"
"By hand."
"How?"
"By placing a man with a lantern at every signal post."
"How? There's not enough clearance."
"We'll use alternate tracks."
"How will the men know which way to throw the switches?"
"By written orders."
By written orders. Just as in the old days."
She pointed to the tower director. "He's working out a schedule of how to move the trains and which tracks to use. He'll write out an order for every signal and switch. He'll pick some men as runners, and they'll keep delivering the orders to every post. And it will take hours to do what used to take minutes. But we'll get those waiting trains into the terminal and out on the road."
"We're to work it that way all night?"
"And all day tomorrow, until the engineer who's got the brains for it shows you how to repair the interlocker."
"There's nothing in the union contracts about men standing with lanterns. There's going to be trouble. The union will object."
"Let them come to me."
"The unification board will object."
"I'll be responsible."
"Well, I wouldn't want to be held for giving the orders."
"I'll give the orders." She stepped out on the landing of the iron stairway that hung on the side of the tower. She was fighting for self-control. It seemed to her for a moment as if she too were a precision instrument of high technology left without electric current, trying to run a transcontinental railroad by means of her two hands. She looked out at the great silent darkness of the Taggart Underground, and she felt a stab of burning humiliation that she should now see it brought down to the level where human lampposts would stand in its tunnels as its last memorial statues. She could barely distinguish the faces of the men when they gathered at the foot of the tower. They came streaming silently through the darkness and stood without moving in the bluish murk, with blue bulbs on the walls behind them and patches of light falling on their shoulders from the tower's windows. She could see the greasy garments, the slack, muscular bodies, the limply hanging arms of men drained by the unrewarding exhaustion of a labor that required no thought. These were the dregs of the railroad, the younger men who could now seek no chance to rise, and the older men who had never wanted to seek it. They stood in silence, not with the apprehensive curiosity of workmen, but with the heavy indifference of convicts.